singing the devil's song. Flowers and sparklers, one in each of my hands. Big stars in my markers, the odors of a man. I don't belong in the devil's song. Let me be ashamed and confound my haste. Cook me in onions and vinegar for taste. I don't belong in the devil's song. With the ridicule instead, I don't belong in the devil's song. Rebuke my beast, that great herd of bulls, with their pieces of silver and their vile book of rules. I don't belong in the devil's.
Couple minutes after the hour of two, that was Little Shiny Ribs for you, the Devil's Song off of, well, Kevin Russell's first offering, well, after a while. And apparently Kevin Russell's going to be at Folk Alliance, which is coming to the Westin Crown Center in a couple of weeks. I think it's early February.
Yeah.
You can check out Folk Alliance's website for more information, because KKFI will have a presence, because we're a bunch of folks down here. We like to folk off as much as we can. At least I do. So just kind of discussing some ideas, some concepts about the economy. I mean, really, we're talking, when we talk about the fact that in two decades, 47% of the workforce would essentially be unneeded because of robotics, technology, et cetera. I mean, what really we're talking about is social justice. This is ultimately what it comes down to. And what more appropriate day to speak about social justice than the observed birthday of Martin Luther King, right?
Right on, right
on. I mean,
on.
This is really the concept that we have here. Because if people are not able to earn their own money for whatever reason, not able to get their own paycheck, and that is maybe the desire, the hope, the goal, or whatever it is, they are not, I mean, that is not social justice. And it would be one thing if nobody was getting a paycheck. But when you have a corporate free-for-all, a big capitalist orgy at the top, and very little taking place at the bottom, to the point where you can't navigate the bureaucracy as an individual on the ground level. I mean, clearly we have a problem. Clearly we are not talking about social justice, to the point where it's almost like, why not just let it all become a free-for-all? I mean, what's the worst that could happen? I mean, are we close to that point in which people are just like, skip it. It's a new Amsterdam. Let's put the Silk Road in our backyard, right? Let's just open it all up.
I think that's the problem is
wide
when
open.
We did open it up, like with the Silk Road, what you get is murder, drugs,
is that right?
And not. Well, at least that's reported to us, right? Right. Like, cause like I said, I would love to hear the story.
You and me
of
did not know anything
trading
about the
businesses.
We did not know anything about the Silk Road whatsoever until they told us about
right.
it. There was nothing like there's questionable activity taking place that we believe originates on the internet that is causing all kinds of localized violence. I didn't know anything about it until
The fact that that they say like billions of dollars trading on this thing, right? Didn't they say like
billions in transactions?
That again, it's like okay, I haven't met the guy who is on unemployment for 2 years. I'm not saying they don't exist, and I don't run with like drug dealers, but where are all these people? I mean, it's a big country, so I may not know. I mean, you know, you got New York, L.A., Chicago.
Yeah, most of them are in either California or Texas. Some are in Florida. Let's go to the phones. 816-931-5534. I say that just because if you ever are reading perverse stories on the internet, you can essentially go, is this in Texas or Florida?
Right.
You know, and sometimes Ohio is in there, too. I don't know why. But Texas or Florida, primarily, if it's a story about, you know, incest or some sort of religious perversion or something like that. It's always Texas or Florida. I don't know
Welcome
why.
Welcome to Texas.
816-931-5534. Good morning. You're on the radio.
No, this is Russ checking in.
Oh, thank God. Why did you never tell us about the Silk Road when you had an opportunity to, Russ?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that...
You're a little
paranoid? If I told you too much, why? I might get in trouble.
I understand.
No, actually, Bush kind of mentioned that when he talked about the inner tubes and so forth.
Oh, way back when, huh?
That's right. He was letting the cat out of the bag then.
I think that was even before the Silk Road, though, right?
Well, that's true, but it's something that some people have thought about when they've had spare time, in the sense that what kings of old and the aristocracy used to do, like out in the open. You know, these things have gone underground in a sense, but probably the worst things you can imagine are going on right now. You just have to be part of whatever that subculture is.
Well, no, that's absolutely true. I don't know if that is necessarily true in regards to the Silk Road, but the worst things that I can possibly imagine and some that I could never imagine are definitely taking place right now.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, and you were talking about the quantum computers and the NSA and so forth. You know, I mean, it's what Mike was talking about, that on the one hand, it's that balancing act between personal liberty and freedom, and your fellow citizens' safety and your own safety.
Yeah, but I mean, right. So then, how much of that personal safety thing, that individual safety that we feel like is granted to us by, you know, our social system, which is based upon a lot of, you know, government in your reality. If you live in a city, if you live in somewhere that has government around, I mean, if you're in the piney woods of Alaska or something like that, you're not going to have any government whatsoever. But how much of that safety is an illusion? How much of kind of the fabric of our society that prevents us from all devolving into a bunch of, you know, zombies? You know, just willing to, you know, I mean, seriously, just to turn us into a bunch of, you know, crazed cannibalistic killers. I mean, what prevents us from doing that? The Kansas City Police Department?
No, I think it's, well, part of it's our social conditioning and upbringing and so forth. Plus, you know, plus it's the whole idea that I don't necessarily want to attack somebody because I might get hurt or killed in return.
That's absolutely
so. Some of that self-interest. You know, I don't want to live in a society where, you know, it's kill or be killed necessarily. I mean, I realize we're living in that society now, but I at least like living in the illusion that it's not quite a total free-for-all.
I mean, some of this government intrusion that we talk about came about because of that, right? I mean, it used to be the land baron could hire Wyatt Earp. Maybe not Wyatt Earp, but you know what I mean? Could hire the biggest, fastest gun and guns to, like, be like, hey, I don't know what y'all doing, but ain't nobody messing with my stuff. You know what I mean? That personal security, personally financed. And then if they decide to be a jerk about it, they can squeeze out the next guy. I mean, maybe that's just from Westerns or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? This is where... Yeah, I did read a book years ago about this whole thing, that's where our gun culture, you know, comes from.
Yeah, but that's always been, I think, if I, you know, I mean, I'm not, you know, an expert, obviously, but I would say with some certainty that no matter what time period you go back into, whether you're, you know, a nomadic tribe, you still have those same kind of dynamics at play. Where it's just a function of the society that you're always going to have somebody in charge. You're always going to have, you know, band together to protect what's yours.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, right. But is that the system that we have today? With a police department and a judicial system?
I mean, it does work to a certain degree.
It works to a certain degree, and there is an avenue for us to make a difference, right? Like if the police are being, you know, brutalizing your community, right? Let's say, you know, the east side of town, and they're doing...
Well, maybe the police was brutalizing the west side of town.
Okay.
Giving people a hard time over on Board Parkway.
But you can band together and start doing. I mean, that's where the Black Panthers came from, right? It was like saying, hey, look, these cats are on the west side.
Yeah, but
of
what happened to the Black Panthers, Mike?
No, I'm not saying. But here's, okay, don't mistake. Because
the Black Panthers, though, did have an impact,
They had a massive impact. We have school lunches programs and things in our normal society now that they were doing, and they took that and then demonized them
the Black Panthers
things.
Ultimately threatened the system of stability created by the government. Right?
Right.
So the government
absorbed the Black Panthers in a sense.
Right. That's my point, is that they demonized the Black Panthers, sent them all to jail. And
that's not what Russ just said. Russ said they got absorbed.
No, well, but their ideology got absorbed.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, right?
Right. So you're an evil, lousy, dirty communist. We're going to run you out of this country or throw you into jail or kill you. But we're going to take your ideas and turn it into the Head Start program and the school lunch program. And everybody gets it. You know, that's not a bad idea. Even white kids could use that. You know what I'm saying? It's
well, that's one reason why the United States, at least in my opinion, has not had a second civil war, you must say. Or in other words, you know, we seem to have the ability here, at least for, you know, we seem to have the ability here to absorb ideas from counter-revolutionary, counter, you know, societal forces, so that in a sense it defuses you know, it defuses some of those issues that might explode.
Or another way to look at it, I think, is...
Do we still have that capability as a society,
though?
Well,
that's the question, isn't it?
I would argue that we've kind of stagnated a little bit within that. Whereas, I mean, certainly what the Black Panther movement did, you know, with people, there was a need for it, too.
Right.
And clearly, Black folks in Oakland were having a problem with the police. Black folks in L.A. were having a problem with the police. They couldn't protect. They couldn't call the police for protection. They needed their own way to handle their own problems because they were being manipulated by outside forces. And by they, I mean the Black community was being manipulated by outside forces.
Right.
So
and although it
that.
Was spun as like the gun thing, there was so much more to the Black Panther Party and their ideas.
Right. Beyond just physical protection, we're talking about, you know, emotional and educational protection and all other types of protection, right? But ultimately, that was a threat to the system. That was the Black Panthers.
Or at least to the people in power, in control of the system.
Huh? The same thing, right?
Well, not exactly, because if I'm in control of the system, like if I'm in the power class, right, and I say, you know, they're right, we should do something different. You get to stay in power, and we have change. That doesn't happen all the time.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what...
That doesn't happen all the time. Sometimes it does. And it happens...
Yeah, but that's a good point because, you know, once again, if you are in power, sometimes you have to bend a little bit to stay in power.
Well,
and then all of a sudden, you become the leader of the band, even though you didn't create the band. You just took over.
And that's what they do all the time.
But that's like we're talking about history books here, aren't
right?
We?
That's always what happens, right? Is the people?
No. But we're talking about something that used to happen in this country that does not happen anymore.
Well, I think
this idea of compromise.
I think even the Occupy people and
no, but it's not compromise.
There wasn't
no compromise with the Black Panther Party. They said we're going to destroy them,
but
then turned around and took. Okay, so now we've got them on the run. We can kill them, but how do we stop?
I mean, within your theoretical situation, where a person in power realizes that things are changing, I need to moderate the way I'm, you know, operating so I can stay in power, and then I end up looking all the much better when it's done. Because
but rarely do they
I'm just
think
saying,
it through that way. What they do is they go, I'm going to kill you, and then they go, now how do I keep this guy from coming back? How do I keep another guy from popping up with that? I know, I better do something about the problems that he was bringing, that he was pointing out. So, you know, his idea of...
What you do is you let the more moderate people in the movement, you invite them into the door.
Right.
And
that's
what happens.
And you
kind of say, look.
Then you end up with John Lewis in Congress
for 15 years. You kind of mollify your people a little bit, and here's a piece of cake. You know, and you become part of the club, you might say.
Then you got Charles Rangel.
I don't want to go too deep there, but that's pretty much it, isn't it?
What's the dude out of Detroit? That's been there forever. Dingell.
Yeah, Charles Dingell.
You know, these people, and I'm not.
Or Bobby Rush.
I'm not hating on all the Black people in Congress on Martin Luther King Day. I'm just saying that you, like Russ said, right, it's a rare thing. Only on Martin Luther King Day can we agree. but yeah, that you bring in the more moderate elements. You kill the kings and the X's and the SEALs and the, you know what I mean? You get those guys, whatever you got to do to take them out, whether it's an economic hitman or a hitman. But then you come back and you take those ideas. And, of course, because you've got the government, you can layer it in bureaucracy and it can take longer, or you can shift how it happens. And, yeah, we got school lunch programs for everybody, but we got poor schools over here. Or, you know what I mean? It's there's other problems, and you can kind of continue to keep those people under you. And But
here's the point, though. Nobody in the higher echelons of whatever you want to call it, the bourgeoisie or whatever, I mean, nobody wants to see a mob come into their house to burn it down. So, you know, that's the stick, and then the carrot, you know, there is a carrot involved here somewhere.
You can make lots of money off of these people. If you're,
well, yeah,
if you give them what they want,
there's a problem riding the wave. You might drown.
But does the bourgeoisie or the 1% or the whoever, the people that should have a little bit of fear of the mob with the pitchforks and the torches and all that stuff, there's no fear there anymore, though, right? I mean, there's no response.
Well,
and that's
it's not just a handful of billionaires or something. I mean, the doctors, the lawyers, et cetera.
The 1% is not a handful of billionaires. That's 1 in 100 people. I mean,
well, no, that's true. But I'm just talking about there still is a fear factor in the top 5%. I mean, there's, you know, if the mob came, I'm certainly they wouldn't come to my house. They'd be going to the bigger houses first. Then they come to my house.
Yeah, I don't know that there is necessarily a concern there. I don't know that there has to be.
There was a concern in the '60s, certainly, when there were 100 cities had problems.
No, absolutely.
There was a fear factor there, and it was a real one.
And there was almost a civil war in the 1960s.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's one of the biggest things King did. He defused what probably would have led to an all-out conflict of some kind.
I don't know that he defused it.
I think he did. I think that's his legacy.
No,
I think he did defuse it.
I don't like that word either, Russ. I would say he directed it. His strategy was what was different. He didn't diffuse the anger or, you know, because diffuse means kind of like it's gone or we're going to just dissipate it. He concentrated it, but then said, we are going to do this in a very strategic way to move things so that we don't end up in some bloody conflict with people dead, more people dead, that doesn't ultimately, you know, you lose your support.
No, that's true. I don't know. Maybe diffuse isn't the right word, but it's something along that line.
Right, he diverted
His impact is certainly no doubt. You know, he's certainly a towering figure of the last 40 years in the United States, or 50 years.
As long as you don't call into question his doctoral thesis.
No, I've let that go because, you know, he got his letter, so that was good enough, I guess. Well, on that happy note, I'm going to go back to losing your mail.
Thanks, Russ.
Bye-bye.
Because, you know, the March on Washington is 1963, and 1965 is when you have an all-out,
you start having riots.
Yeah, I mean, melee across this country because you have social and economic transition that's not necessarily for the benefit of the folks, not necessarily the people that are making out on that one because you have the beginnings of deindustrialization, the destruction of the urban core, and the creation of the suburban, you know, fortress where people move out there and no longer have to deal with the interaction of the city, this dense, you know, kind of melting pot thing. We just separate ourselves out into economic stratification. You know, and I just, when talking about the way, you know, the way that we incorporate, you know, revolution and counter-revolution into our society and these things get absorbed into it and these abstract conversations about, you know, the way progress comes about and the way that people in power latch on to things after they've kind of after they've passed a little bit because it becomes advantageous or it was a good idea in the first place or whatever it was. I just don't know is that possible now? You know, can you have that? I mean, everything is so incredibly polarized. I mean, it seems so much more. I mean, people keep asking me why Chris Christie is such a big deal. I mean, you know, why is the Bridgegate? Why is him not wanting to give the city of Hoboken, Sandy emergency aid. I mean, all these accusations that are being thrown right. about. Why is Chris Christie such a big target? I mean, you can make a lot of jokes here, obviously. You know, why do I think Chris Christie is such a big target? Because in an era of extreme partisanship, he comes out as somebody who's a bit of a moderate, who has to be a bit of a moderate because he is a Republican governor of a Democratic state, right? So he's somebody that seems to be a compromiser, somebody that might be, you know, a rational voice of reason. He's not Ted Cruz. You know, he's not right. somebody that is just a polar extremist that literally seems to be, you know, using rhetoric for the sake of just pissing people off and energizing a fanatic base of, you know, lunatics. It's similar to the governor of Missouri, you know, Jay Nixon, who's Democratic governor of a red state. I mean, he has to be a compromiser. He has right. to listen to people who he doesn't agree with. He can't just surround himself with a bunch of, you know, sycophants who are gonna, you know, just cheerlead whatever extreme position, you know, he feels he needs to take. He actually has to listen to his political opponents. And he has to take their opinion seriously and move forward within that. I mean, it's
right.
just,
at least at that level of the game within the state.
So is that a threat to, you know, the political establishment now? Because we've gotten to the point where everything is so polarized. Everything is so extreme, you know, partisanship, where you can't even have the illusion of people working together for the benefit of governing the people or something like that.
Right.
And Chris Christie kind of represents a threat to that polarization because he is not a polarizing figure. He's being made into a polarizing figure. And I mean, in any way, I mean, it's progress if the governor of New Jersey is trying to exact political payback and it doesn't involve bodies in the trunk of a Cadillac at Newark Airport. I mean, that's progress, isn't it? I mean, it's just these things right. take place. This is the way politics works. I mean, it's similar to, you know, the way Rod Blagojevich, the disgraced governor of Illinois, when he sold Barack Obama's, you know, senatorial seat, you know, this idea that I'm not going to give up this thing, which is a piece of gold for nothing. I want to get reelected, goddammit. Somebody's going to have to make a nice big contribution
and once
to my
again, he
reelection
was
campaign.
Undone by the way he said something. You know, it was just some words that they were able to catch him. Because nobody, I don't think, is under the impression that that's not the kind of thing that happens all the time.
Well, I think some people are.
That they.
Some people seem to downright indignant at the idea of that being the case. But, I mean, that's clearly the way politics operates. And that's probably, again, as far as the way a governor of Illinois could operate, is probably not the worst thing that.
Right. It could be so much worse. He could, like, kill people. Right.
Right. Come back to that, which is, you know, where it would seem as though, you know, some of these people are organized criminals or you know,
I think
hard
they
to
are.
Differentiate between the two.
I think they are.
Quite hard to differentiate between the two. But social justice, it's an interesting concept. It's an interesting idea. And it, I mean, it would seem as though that we have kind of replaced materialism with social justice, that if you have, you know, with material gain, if you have items, if you have a flat screen TV and, you know, consumer goods, you have a smartphone, then you can be, you know, then you have social justice. You have some sort of benefit from society because you get to play with the same toys that the rich boys have. 47% of all jobs will be automated in the next two decades, according to at least one economist. And where will the people fit in to that is the real question that I would like to have answered.
Well, and this goes back to you were gone and probably asleep by 4 o'clock. But this was my diatribe, if you want to call it that, last week, was that we are at a point where we have to reconsider the jacket. You know, I don't have internet connection over here, so I can't pull it up. But, you know, I talked about, like, my favorite Thomas Jefferson quote from his memorial in Washington, D.C., was about the people having to make these decisions about the government that they live under, because it would be like a man giving his son a coat. You can't just, like, say, here, wear that. It's got to be tailored for you. You know what I'm saying? It comes from somewhere. Like, we are the inheritors of Jefferson and Lincoln and Roosevelt and Eisenhower and all that. But we got to tailor this thing, because they none of those guys had to deal with the automation that you're talking about. None of them had to deal with, you know, what Roosevelt did, whether people like it, love it, hate it, with the whole New Deal, was because we were at a point where more than 47% of the people weren't on the dole, right? There wasn't a dole. But they were at this distressed and harassed point where we could have had a very radical change, a revolution of sorts. I mean, I remember talking about this about 5 or 6 years ago, learning that in some documentary having to do with Roosevelt, how farmers, and I can't remember if it was Kansas or Iowa, had rushed into a government, to a courthouse, and taken the judge hostage and said, you're not going to sign any more freaking foreclosures. Right? Because the people were like, no. However this system is set up, and we all signed up and got on the line, you know, we all got into this individually, but we're going to make some, you know what I mean? There was a banding of people starting. And I think, you know, I've heard it said that Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself by creating the social networks or the
safety nets.
That's, you know, what was, had it not happened, we would have had a radical change in our complete existence. And I don't know how it would have come out, because you never know. I mean, because, you know, Russ made the point or comment that they're not going to get to his house. The people at the bottom, they got to get to where, you know, to get to that 1% out in, I don't know, what do you want to say?
Hallbrook.
Okay. To get there, they got to go through Leawood. And Leawood may not be the 1%, but if you're coming from Gwinnett, I don't think Gwinnett's there anymore. If you're coming from the projects, it sure as hell looks like the 1%. And if you're wait, you're not going to be like, nope, we're not burning that one. We're going to wait till we get all, you know what I'm saying? You don't revolt at the top first. You get there. You know what I mean? You start where you are, and you keep moving. It's that flame thing. It spreads. It goes. It doesn't. It's not like people are rationally thinking, hey, who we need to go after? The Soros guy, right? Or the Kochs or whatever. They start. Man, look at that guy. He's got 7 cars. And I can't feed my kids. That's got to be the 1%, right? That's got to be the 1%. You don't know what the 1% looks like. So you can't, like, go, hey, I'm not rich. I'm a working man. That's not going to sell to those people if they get to that point, to that mob mentality, that anger mentality. So you have to...
Yeah, my whole point is that people aren't, I mean, you know, people can get to the mob mentality, they can get to the anger mentality, but, I mean, like you said, the New Deal saved capitalism from itself.
Right, and he was a rich guy. He was a one percenter.
Oh, name the president who wasn't.
Right.
So, the idea...
That's fair.
The idea then being is that so you have a like a safety valve,
right?
A place to let the steam off to kind of prevent things from getting to the point where it would require, you know, some sort of upheaval of society,
right?
Or a correction. Same way that people within Wall Street talk about market corrections, that right. the Federal Reserve distorts, you know, money and the market to the point where you don't have these corrections that need to take place. And by correction, I mean drop in the stock price of companies. You know, so you have something that is
artificial.
That is artificial. That is a fugazi. It's a manipulation. And we can sit here and go, because, I mean, stocks are, what, over 16,000? The Dow Jones Industrials are over 16,000 or something like that.
Right.
Folks, that doesn't mean nothing. Especially if, you know, you're not making any money. I mean, literally, the idea that there's some sort of, you know, general connection between, you know, Joe Sixpack and the Dow Jones Industrials.
A share of Google is like 10 grand or something?
No, it's like 500 bucks. But
right. Oh, is that all?
What, that seems affordable to you all of a sudden?
No. No, it seems like there was somebody's stock price that I heard that was like over $1,000.
Yeah, maybe so. I'm sure there are those out there. Again, I don't know. I mean, I don't play with the stock market.
Right. That just shows you that it's so not even in your league to like be going like, oh, I play the market. Like, no, you don't. You got some mutual funds.
Yeah. That safety net, the safety valve, the steam valve, that blow off. I mean, that's just kind of how society has been set up to where what is going to come about from the friction of people being people. I mean, everything is so, you know, contrived and controlled. Now, where our perspective on ourselves based upon what the TV and the, you know, social media, the internet tell us that we are, you know, when we look into kind of the zeitgeist of where we're at in society, we look back in the mirror shows us what we are, but it's not necessarily a genuine representation of what's going on. It's a marketed, manipulated one because it's based upon advertising. Commercialism. I mean, that's what this is. Right. It's not necessarily based upon the reality of your life. You know, the reality of your participation within your job, based upon, you know, you being a part of you know, some sort of, you know, union or organization where, you know, you're meeting. I mean, it's just, you know, being really vulnerable on so many levels to all kinds of, you know, manipulations from, you know, people who have the power and ability to do so, leaving people just kind of out there and exposed, you know, and not having necessarily a recourse to do anything. I mean, clearly when people rioted, you know, in the 60s for social justice, I mean, the government sent in tanks, put them on the streets,
all right.
You know, National Guard, militarized the cities, you know, for the purposes of preventing a breakdown of that social fabric, because people in power, the structure of that, want the status quo to remain because it's on them. I mean, their very livelihood, their power is based upon that.
Right.
So when the Black Panthers show up to provide something that they can't get from the police department or from the court systems or from the public schools, now that becomes an immediate threat. So then things have to get moderated a little bit so we can move in this direction, and we'll have to destroy this group, but we'll incorporate some of their ideas
right.
into other aspects of, you know, the way government operates. And I don't know that we, as a society, can still do that. I mean, the real test, I guess, will be to see what, I mean, it's just the amazing goldmine of information that Edward Snowden has provided us about the boogeyman of the National Security Agency. I mean, what the end result of that will be. I mean, if WikiLeaks brought us a bunch of information about the way war is fought, the way America views its allies and its enemies diplomatically, I'm not sure what necessarily came about from that. I'm not sure what WikiLeaks ultimately has provided America as a society as far as a perspective on itself. I don't know if any of that was taken to heart. But the information that Edward Snowden has put out there is just so much more, I mean, damning. I mean, everyone, you kind of know that war is bad.
Right.
Because people are killing people and, you know, you kind of justify it because we're the good guys and we ultimately just want to bring those people over there a little bit of freedom or a little bit of this or that. But this, you get this perspective that if America has turned into, you know, a paranoid and delusional megalomaniacal control grid. I mean, will people decide that that's not what we want? I mean, whatever type of public relations stunt the White House offers up as a mediation to the issues within the NSA will be just that. It's just going to be PR. I mean, not going to really be able to do much of anything. Because, I mean, what the organization's become is a self-perpetuating machine. It can't stop itself. I mean, right. it's how do you pull the plug on it? How do you change it? How do you soften it up? How do you have privacy today? Do we just accept the fact that it's not something you have? I mean, what will the end result be? People are just going, oh yeah, okay. It's the way it is.
Well, I mean, other than that the government is downloading it and storing it so that they can look at it when they want to look at it. Because I don't think that they're looking at me, looking at what I'm looking at and doing what I'm doing. But if I ever become a person of interest to them, a thorn in their side, you know, you do run that risk.
Well, right. But then again, but what will people do with that information?
You mean we the people? There's not, I mean,
what was done with the Pentagon Papers or, you know, the story?
Well, obviously, that, they're still doing it, right? I mean, that's what WikiLeaks is.
That just came out about the break-in of that FBI office in suburban Philadelphia back in 1971, where, you know, the concerned citizens, you know, and for the investigation of the FBI released a bunch of documents to journalists.
Right, and exposed COINTELPRO.
Exactly. Right. And just this idea that, you know, Hoover was spying on the anti-war movement, you know, black power movements, all the other social justice movements of the
1960s. But then you had like your
70s.
Church committee.
Yeah, no, that was the outcome of that.
Right. And you had like, we're not going to do this, we're not going to allow that. And then obviously by the 80s and 90s, we're right back into it. So which means we probably never left it. But I mean, I don't know, man. It's that's a tough one because I don't know what you're supposed to do. I mean, that's the hard part.
Well, no, but it's an opportunity for, you know, society to go, here's information about the way we are. Is this the way we want to be?
Right.
And do we still have, as people, the ability to participate within that and to decide to continue on or to reject this? Do we just go, okay, America is now a paranoid, delusional, you know, control grid nanny state? Is that what we want? Will that keep us safe from terrorism? Will that help me sleep better at night? You know, can I give up the Ambien knowing that the NSA is out there making sure that everyone's safe and sleep well or not? I mean, is that the trade-off? Is that what people will ultimately accept? Or are we just so far removed from it, it doesn't matter anyway? I mean, that's really the question, is the indifference or apathy of it all, which I think is really perpetuated by this whole, you know, extreme partisanship. That just shuts people down 100%. When you got, you know, the Tea Party on one side and, I don't know, whatever the flip side of that is. It's not Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, but whatever I mean, maybe it is. I don't know. But when you have just this extreme polarity, and the, you know, people who literally are not representing seemingly anyone, but are, you know, given a microphone and right. The camera's pointed at them, and we're told that these people are the ones that are
left and the
politically
right.
powerful right now. It just shuts people down, and why would you care? Like, you don't want to listen to a couple people, you know, bickering over a bunch of meaningless crap. I mean, do you think nobody wants to listen to you argue with your wife or your girlfriend about, you know, who didn't leave the towels in the washing machine? Nobody wants to hear that, you know, and it's just kind of like, so it just shuts people out. So then why would I want to participate? Why would I care to engage or be informed?
But I would say,
what benefit does it provide me?
That's where Snowden comes in, right? Is it's like, okay, you do have a reason to pay attention.
Yeah, but he's just like, right, but he's just the guy. I mean, he's
right,
the
but
catalyst.
I mean, but he thrust that in our face, right? It's there now, and they're continuing. I mean, the thing is, we're almost a year into it, and they're still, like, I think I heard, I can't remember, there's two guys. There's like Glenn Greenwald, and then who was the other guy?
I mean, Glenn Greenwald is the main guy that's been dumping
the stuff out. But there's another guy that I heard an interview with, and he was like talking about some more stuff that he's about to bring out again, or, you know, more new stuff. And I appreciate how they are bringing that out a little at a time instead of here's, you know,
I think all the
just
information
an overwhelming amount.
I mean,
of
Snowden's not getting new information. I mean, this is all information.
Right, this
that
is all stuff that he's given
them. It's just getting
them,
processed,
and then they're putting it out in pieces, which is good because that allows me to say, okay,
be able to digest.
Really ticked off about that program. Oh my God, another program, and then you start to have this, and this is what I'm saying is like, this may be that catalyst. Eventually, I ain't looking for tomorrow, but that catalyst that will eventually bring your Tea Party and your Occupy elements together, not your Ted Cruz, because he's not real. You know what I'm saying? He's not a real guy, but that real guy that's out there working and buying it, maybe he starts to process that a little bit more, because it just keeps coming. And you got to keep stacking this up, this disclosure and this disclosure and this disclosure against your ideology. And then you got to stop and go, okay, the people who are so, you know, as we look at these programs.
So then what would the end result be? Another church committee? Another, you know, House Select Committee on Assassinations? I mean, what would...
Maybe it becomes something like that, where we come up with some kind of, like, actual, like, we get it to
do
bubble
people,
up through the Congress.
But the idea that... But
some
I mean,
sort
really,
of
do people,
informational freedom of, you
do
know...
Do people have a recourse? You know, do people have... Is there an aspect of
it will
this?
Not be immediate. It will not be immediate
response.
because it the only way that you have immediate change is like the French Revolution, where you like end up killing all these people, and that ain't a good thing. You know what I mean? I don't want to rise up. Let's get all the people who were in charge, because it's again, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about revolution. I'm saying that will you have if people can't? Would the government still respond to people? Did the government ever respond to people? Does it just try to triage the prospect of losing control, you know, the power structure losing control because of social unrest? I mean, is that all that ever took place? You know, they only respond to social movement or political change because you have to. You have to ride that or, you get knocked off your surfboard. You have to ride that wave or you end up, off the board in the water.
But that's where it becomes critical for us to...
And what would that ultimately look like? Because we can historically say that we have seen that. I mean, if you literally think about all the disclosure and the mentality of people in the early 70s and how that did eventually yield the United States Congress looking openly and plainly into this kind of this boogeyman spy versus spy spook world that had, been grown out of the national security, state that was declared after World War II in the name of the Cold War and communism. I mean, literally. So then we're shining a light in these shadows that were created to fight, war for corporate hegemonic imperial domination of the world or whatever it is. And then, within just a few years of that, it's morning in America again and Reagan's president. And then we have the 80s. And then you just kind of, then we go backwards, if you would view the disclosure of what the CIA and the FBI were doing as progress, which I would. In an open society, I would justify that as being progress. And then you just, everything just slips backwards in the 80s. So it's kind of incrementalism to ride the wave, kind of feel it and go, all right, people want to see... some light shown on these cobwebs and these shadows, and we'll do that. But it doesn't really matter because, and that was you have to assume that people's attention spans were longer back then. I mean, now it's just a blip of an eye. If people were limited in their access to social media and entertainment via the internet, then you might have, some real concern from people, right? I mean, if their daily lives were affected by this, but we're still in the abstract, right? This notion that, hey, I'm not really doing anything, so I'm not really worried about my metadata or some of my actual data being scooped up by the NSA because they're not going to find anything about me and they'll just keep moving along. And that's just kind of, it's the nature of things. It's the world we live in because you can't have both. You can't have free and open society and then have the NSA and all these other aspects of government intrusion and manipulation that evoke, thoughts of East Germany, in Soviet Russia. It's really what it comes down to. You can't have both. I mean, one of those has to be an illusion, right? And it seems like
one of the which has to be an illusion.
Well, we either live in a paranoid, delusional, nanny state control grid, or we live in a free, open society and country. I mean,
but we live in both.
Well, but then that means that the free place is not real. It's just an illusion of a free place. It's only kept free because nobody's taken your freedom away yet. Nobody said,
But that's always the case, right?
Is that always the case? Because you had a long time throughout history where government did not have these tools at their disposal.
You could go out to the Wyoming Territory and they'd have to marshal up forces to come out there and civilize it and make it,
I'm saying that there was a time in which people were responsible for moderating themselves and kind of deciding who got to be free or not. I mean, Dirty Jim is free to, rape girls in his cave, or whatever. But when, the community is like, Dirty Jim, you've raped your last girl and we're stopping you from doing so, then it's done. I don't know if that made any sense at all. But this idea
that
if you give people freedom, that all that's going to happen is, rape, murder, and greed. And you're going to see the worst side of humanity. And that's something that is taught to us, that we are inculcated with, that we are forced to believe. That if you let people just be free and don't manipulate them with a police state and a bunch of interference, through from government to Hollywood and society, you know, that you will just see an absolute medieval pandemonium of just illicit, illegal, nasty, disturbing behavior. You know, that somehow it's because we live in a controlled society, which we do, that's what prevents us from being the animals that we really are. And that's just, I don't believe that for a second. It's really what we're talking about. I also don't believe for a second that the National Security Agency is collecting all the information they can to keep us safe from terrorism. I don't believe that either.
No, absolutely not.
I don't think that
absolutely
has,
not.
Even if terrorism was truly the existential threat that the government would like us to believe that it is,
that ain't the most effective way to do it. Or fight it.
It's what they're doing.
It's not. Looking at what I'm doing is not the most effective way to fight terrorism, because I ain't got nothing to do with that.
Well, I think the most effective way to fight terrorism is, again, through social justice. Probably be
absolutely
the way. I mean, I know I sound like a total liberal douchebag when I say stuff like that, but it's mostly true. If people have, you know, the things they need and they feel like somebody's listening to them, you know, they have recourse and they don't have to necessarily become, you know, violent. But if somebody is blowing up your water buffalo and bombing your sister's wedding, you're going to, you know, feel a certain way about that. And you might be motivated to do something about that in regards to becoming violent because you're angry. And you don't feel like you have any other way to act out, and you feel like you need to act out because your pride's been hurt, or, you know, your integrity has been damaged.
But how different is that from the experience of the American Indian in this country, right? Where there was no the people saying, hey, government, stop doing that. You know what I mean? Now we have a different mindset. I mean, it's a couple hundred years later. And there is that blowback from within our own society to not be doing these things that you're talking about, blowing up and killing and taking somewhere else.
Well, it's just now, I mean, it was literally justified before as, you know, these Indians are savages. They don't have the same feelings as we do. You know, and we need their land. But it doesn't matter if we take the land from them. We'll just put them on other land and they'll figure it out. I mean, now, instead of saying these people are, you know, savages without feelings, we just go, these are Muslims without, you know, religion or something like that.
Right.
Muslims without morals.
It's just the way they are.
Right.
But we'll invite them in to become, you know.
Because ultimately, the game is the same. We just want their land. We want to be able to be in geographic control of that plot. I mean, the game is not necessarily changed, but, you know, we've told ourselves that we're playing it for different reasons now. I mean,
right.
nobody thought, I don't know, maybe you could go back and find some historical record where they said, you know, the Trail of Tears was actually going to benefit the Indians. You know, once they get to, you know, beautiful Oklahoma, they'll, you know, get to have
I think
nice
they actually
life.
Did try and
yeah, maybe.
Sell it. That, you know, hey, this is going to be good for everybody.
But did they? But did
we're going to get
well,
the land,
I mean,
and they're going
to
sure,
be. But did they need to sell it? I mean, were there people out there? I mean, was there a large enough segment of the population that was
resisting
morally or ethically
kind of,
concerned
right.
with the idea of the exploitation of, you know, the Indian to perpetuate the white man's condition? I mean, probably not. I mean, it's, you know. I mean, I'm sure the abolitionist minded folk was also concerned with the Indians' situation to a certain degree. You wouldn't assume, but at the same time,
I think there's another dynamic that's at play in that kind of thing, and it's the same that's here now. It's like, you know, if the three of us are somewhere and we're together, we're the same versus them. If you get up and go knock one of those guys out and take his stuff, there's a certain tendency that we have to kind of like Man, now what? You shouldn't have done that, dude. But we're not going to take it from you and give it back to him. We're not going to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, let me check out what you got.
Right, right. We go, dude, you really should not have done that. That is a pretty cool lighter. Can I have that?
It's now 3 o'clock.